Straw Hut Media.
So you kind of don't want it to end, or maybe you do want it to end, but you don't want to be alone after it ends. Is this normal, what I'm feeling right now?
Yeah.
We're like, oh yes, you felt that too. Okay, cool. Yeah.
You felt personally attacked. Yeah.
Yeah.
Welcome to Conversations with Friends and Strangers. I'm Maggie.
I'm Noam.
In this show, we take a closer look at the complicated relationships in the Hulu series Conversations with Friends.
We'll meet some of the cast and crew, chat with experts, and share our own kind of sexy, kind of uncomfortable, but relatable stories about the messy relationships we find ourselves in. It's our final episode.
I know, I feel conflicted.
I feel sad. I'm gonna miss my friends.
I'm gonna miss my strangers.
But today, we get a lot of great stuff, and you want to know, can you really call someone out for hurtful behavior and communicate through a conflict?
We talked to producer Jeannie Igo about the differences between Melissa on the page and Melissa on the screen.
We learned some conflict resolution techniques, and Maggie tells us about the time she waited 7 years to apologize.
Mm-hmm. We talk about the series overall and our feelings.
And our feelings about the series overall, and we ask some questions about a possible season two. But first, our last recap.
Frances is looking very alone.
Yeah, she's kind of in a depression hibernation mode.
And a copy of her story arrives in the mail, so she calls Melissa and asks why she showed Bobby the story. Melissa drops some major wisdom on her.
The way you have behaved has had real consequences.
Frances writes an apology email to Bobby. It's a very good email.
They reconcile, they have sex, and they start their lives together as lovers.
Time passes. She seems to be having her life together. And then around Christmas time, she gets an accidental phone call from Nick that ends with Frances saying, "Come get me."
In the novel, Melissa comes off pretty badly. And it's not hard to join in with Frances in villainizing her.
You know, she was that much, a little bit harder.
Mm-hmm.
And not meaner, but maybe just slightly.
This is producer Jeannie Igo. I'm starting to kind of think of her as our Conversations with Friends shaman.
That coldness of Melissa, I don't think really works in the adaptation as much for on screen, because you're not so in Frances's head and experiencing what she's experiencing. And you see it through Frances's reaction that is what she feels and how she sees Melissa. But, you know, Melissa is a very complex person and has her own life, and this is her husband, and, you know, it has so many layers to it.
Your actions have impact. Your writing has impact. The way you have behaved has had real consequences.
Okay.
You made my depressed husband happy for a while. And then you gave up when things got complicated. And you weren't the center of the fucking everything. And now he's struggling again. And you call me as though you're the fucking victim. Please, please leave us alone.
I'm sorry, Melissa. I'm sorry for this, aggressive phone call. It was stupid. I don't really know what I'm doing at the moment. I'm having a hard time, maybe.
I'm sorry you're having a hard time. Are you okay, Frances?
First of all, I think Jemima just brings more of a, she brings a relatability maybe to it that makes Melissa's character so much more sympathetic, you know, than than in the book. And also just some of the ways that the conversations went. Like, for the one that really stood out to me was the one where Frances calls Melissa on the phone to ask her why she showed Bobby her story. And in the book, I reread that conversation in the book recently, because I was like, you know, this is such a powerful moment in the series where Melissa is able to Jemima as Melissa is able to give her some wisdom and, you know, be a little bit harsh. Well, yeah, pretty harsh, but also almost constructive. And it feels like a catalyst. It feels like something that really changes Frances's perspective. Whereas in the book, what Melissa says to her doesn't necessarily seem to have that big of an effect. And, you know, you could make the argument that it's all how Frances sees it, you know, versus how it actually took place. But it really changed the way that I felt about Melissa based on seeing it on screen.
Yeah, you know? That's definitely what it felt to me. It's hard because I'm a purist, but in the end, I was like, yeah, that's a much better way to do it. We get it. And it kind of shows us where we stand, and it kind of puts Frances, it humbles her and straightens her at the same time. And she understands kind of her perspective of her relationship with Bobby.
Mm-hmm.
Totally. I mean, like, think of your headspace, though, as like a 21-year-old, 22-year-old. Like, it's so, you're so self-involved, you know, you're so, everything is about you, like everything is happening to you. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, in that call, and Melissa just takes her out of it and just gives her just like a quick reality slap of like, hey, he's my husband. You have come into my life and you have changed things, and it is not all about you. Like kind of, I don't know. It's such a powerful conversation, and it is. I think you're right. It's such a catalyst to how Frances kind of brings herself out of it and realizes how selfish she's being. And like, it kind of happens so suddenly, because that is how I think as in your early 20s, you don't really realize the effect you have on people as well. Mm-hmm. And it's something I think I'm still learning now. Like, with friendships and relationships, and I look back and I think I've had this experience with someone and they think it's been totally different. And like, it's crazy what you tell yourself, like how you tell yourself you're a good friend, how you tell yourself you're doing the right thing. But actually, we all make mistakes and we all are very selfish people.
Yeah, 100%. Also, I think it shows how mature Frances is becoming and how big she is as a person to kind of own it. She does wake up, which makes us love her more, because mm-hmm. she's a difficult character to love. In the book too, every time I read this book, I'm like, you're me and I hate you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but like, it's so true. But you, like, you get so frustrated at her, but you, like, she's doing the best she can as well. And like, it is a really hard time as well. It's like, you know, you're not in college. You are a grown up now. You're in the world. And I think Frances is realizing that. And she, you know, with the help of Melissa and with the help of like Bobby holding her accountable too, I think that's a really important part of it as well. Mm-hmm. But I think in order for her to go back to Bobby as a better version, she needed that kind of outside perspective and kind of someone who wasn't going to sugarcoat it for her, and someone wasn't speaking out. Even though Melissa is going through pain, you don't feel like she's speaking out to Frances from only a place of pain. It's kind of a place of wisdom as well.
Are you okay, Frances?
I'm fine. You don't sound fine.
I just haven't been the person that I should have been. Sorry, I don't know what I'm saying now. I wish I had been more thoughtful. I guess I want to apologize for that. I'm gonna hang up now.
Brutal but very true things. And while it's important that she held Frances accountable, there really wasn't any attempt at resolution.
Melissa, on the other hand, though harsh, managed to stay empathetic.
And all this had us thinking about the best ways to try and resolve conflict. Because for most of us, our initial instinct is like Bobby's. It's aggression.
It sort of will end up driving us apart.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. if we know how to hold this conversation, if we have certain things in mind.
This is Ranjita Jarkar. She practices and teaches nonviolent communication skills, and she talked to us all the way from Bangalore.
So when we're talking about interactions that can potentially be uncomfortable or that are uncomfortable and we're broaching, there's a couple of things for me that make the difference between such a conversation leading to more connection or leading to disconnection. I think the tendency often is to either express ourselves unfiltered and to say, here's my honesty, take it. Mm-hmm. And then that becomes sort of an equivalent of dumping.
And the other, which is very common, is waiting until things get super intense before even trying to have a conversation.
And then when the intensity builds so much, I don't actually have a lot of space to listen to either me or you.
If you want to have a conversation about conflict and your goal is resolution, here are some things you can do before entering that space.
The first is I want to get super clear for myself about why it, does this matter to me? And this is really central to the practice of nonviolent communication itself, which is that everything we do, we're doing to meet a need. Any emotion that's stimulated in us is telling us about some need or the other that we have.
If you're not clear about what you're feeling and why, it'll be that much harder to try and explain it to the other person, and that much less likely they'll understand.
So prep, for sure, helps with hard conversations. Mm-hmm. Just a little bit of reflection before about what happened, why does this matter to me? Why, you know, I'm feeling sad. What is the sadness telling me about? The other part for me is, instead of saying something like, you're such a lousy friend, can I actually express my internal experience? Because saying you're a lousy friend is more like a judgment on the other person. And my internal experience is more like, hey, you said you'd show up to help me with the work that I had on my plate last week, and I didn't see you. What happened? I'm disappointed. And I was really hoping to have your support with that. It becomes easier for people to hear us when we're not blaming them, because when we blame people, their defenses go up. They have a choice to either defend themselves or to attack us back. But when I'm actually talking about me and how your actions have impacted me, it's a lot easier for you to hear, I'm guessing, because it's not so much about a judgment of you, but it's more like, this is how I'm experiencing this situation.
When it comes to resolving conflict that feels like a pattern, say your friend consistently hides important information from you, Ranjitha says the key is to be specific.
First, I'd suggest taking one thing at a time, or maybe alluding to, hey, I remember this happening maybe two times in the past or something like that. Because the more specific I can be, the less it's likely the other person is going to hear it as, this is exactly the person you are and I know it. And I think it's also about clarifying it enough for me to get clear about my own experience enough that I can say, at this moment, what I want to talk about is this and this, and to really identify what are those two or three things that I want to talk about in this moment, rather than talking about the entirety of our experience, because that's huge. And how, you know, the more specific, the more granular I can be, it's the easier it is to actually initiate a conversation and start connecting with the other person.
Nonviolent communication has a four-step framework. It's very cool and very helpful. We'll link more info about Ranjitha and nonviolent communication practice in the show notes. And who knows, maybe you'll win your next fight.
I think you may have missed the point.
Perhaps. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, Maggie's 7-year late apology, magic mushrooms, and Dr. Martha Kaupi shares their secret ingredient in lasting relationships.
Welcome back. Today, for our final episode, we're looking at conflict and resolution. Is it possible to call someone out for the way they've hurt you in a constructive way? What if you're the asshole and no one calls you out on it? Remember that story I told you in episode 1 about playing in a band with my ex? The part of that story that I left out is about the guy who played drums with us during the time Anthony was gone.
He was not as good as Anthony. Anthony is a musical genius.
Max was not a musical genius,
but enthusiastic in his in his blasé way.
It was 2009 and I was 19 going on 20. I was living in Long Beach and going to school, but still managing to drive down to LA to party at least once a week, and I struck up a friendship with Max. He was like, oh, I play drums. I can play drums. And I think I was talking to him at a bar or something, and I was like, great. And he lived in LA. He was older. He was in his 30s. He seemed very cool to me at the time. And he started playing drums with us instead.
How long was it before you slept with him?
I can't remember exactly, but not long.
Is twice a pattern?
I have a really hard time separating my creative feelings from my romantic feelings. So I think I do have a connection to music, and that's also why I'm in love with Michael, and he'll never love me back the way that I want.
That's because I have a very strict rule about creative partner romances.
Yeah, it's the only
reason. That's the only reason.
No strict rules about vaginas at all.
No.
Very pro, famously.
I wouldn't say Max and I were ever in a relationship, but we were fond of one another, and there were a few instances where we crossed that line into more than friends.
A romance of convenience, maybe.
Very convenient to have a 21-year-old around, you know?
Yeah, well, and I think there's also the factor of, like, we're spending a lot of time together, and we're drinking a lot together, mm-hmm. playing at these shows, and, like, that it just kind of happens. So there have been some other gay dude in the band, I probably would have been boning him, too. So. Yeah,
you would have been.
There just definitely wasn't ever, so.
And that is the true tragedy of this story.
After about 7 or 8 months of playing shows with Max, Anthony said he was thinking about rejoining the band. And this was big because we'd really been feeling Anthony's absence in the music.
So it wasn't just he wasn't as good as Anthony, it's that he wasn't that good generally.
No. And sorry, we should also say that we weren't that good either.
No.
Anthony was doing a lot of the heavy lifting when it came to musicality and the way that we played. Yeah. And I don't think we realized how much work he did as a drummer until we got a different drummer who was more, you know, I wasn't a fantastic guitar player at that time. You were probably a lot better at bass than I was at guitar and probably at guitar, actually, at that point.
And you know what I remember about really like the biggest contribution from our time playing with Max is that the sound really evolved. That was the first time we were playing with a full drum kit and not using a cajon anymore, and things got a lot louder and a lot fuller, and we really like went from being like a coffee shop folk kind of thing to like a rock band.
The way I remember it, we got an opportunity for a show that felt like a big deal.
I don't remember what the show was, but I can certainly imagine us at the time saying like, this is going to be a big show, so this is our reason to book Anthony instead mm-hmm. of Max, and using that as some kind of excuse to be like, well, it's important, so we have to make this choice.
Changing drummers doesn't have to be dramatic. Bands switch lineups all the time. It was the way we did it that still just mortifies me.
It was like we ghosted our own drummer.
Rather than talking to Max about it, we just booked the show with Anthony. It was so shitty. And yeah. I remember it was like the day before or the day of the show, he texted me and he said, do we have a show tonight? Or do we have a show tomorrow?
Oh, God. I remember that moment where he texted you and he's like, he's asking right now if we have a show. I was like, oh, God, what do we tell him? And yeah. I also very specifically remember telling people about it afterwards, and they asked, like, who's like, what happened to your old drummer? And we would tell them the story, and we would always say, like, He texted us asking if we have a show, and we said, well, we have a show. You don't have a show.
Oh, God, like, it hurts.
Something horrible like that. I don't even remember if those are the words that we used to him. I kind of don't think that we would have been that cruel, but mm-hmm. I just remember that is the language that the retelling took on when people asked us about what happened to our old drummer, is mm-hmm. that's how we told the story. So we were aware that we had done something shitty.
And that was the end of Max. No one reached out to him to explain or to apologize, and no one called us out for being so shitty.
It was just like one day we were a band, and then all of a sudden we weren't, and we never spoke again until, yeah. I mean, like, I think literally years later, because we couldn't overcome our own shame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we really, like, he would have understood, you know, we could have said, we're going to go back to this other drummer that we've played with, and we still want to be friends, and we really enjoyed this time together, but we were children and we are afraid of that confrontation, and so instead we just were shitheads about it, you know.
When I moved to LA proper in 2016, I passed him in the parking lot at Trader Joe's. I waved to him, and the look he gave me was just pure ice, and I suddenly noticed the void where my apology should have been. So I wrote him a message on Facebook 7 years late. Hey Max, this may seem to come out of nowhere, but I am writing to apologize for the shitty way I left things with you and Squarefish all those years ago. Honestly, I did a lot of shitty things when I was younger. Sometimes I blame it on my underdeveloped frontal lobe, sometimes my self-centeredness, sometimes my starry-eyed naivete translated into narcissism. Either way, you are my friend and my collaborator, and I just cut you out with no explanation or consideration. And regardless of how mediocre my band was, that wasn't okay. I'm sure the whole thing is/was just a blip on your radar,
and that has completely left your mind, but for my own peace of mind, I want you to know that I am truly sorry. I hope your life is happy and productive and full of beauty, old friend. P.S. No, I'm not in a 12-step program. Jeez, can't a girl just apologize? He read the message, but he never responded. Until just a few weeks ago. It's why this story is on my mind. All he said was that he was thinking about me and that he hoped I was well.
I'm glad you apologized after 7 years, and I'm glad he accepted your apology 5 years after that. I mean, that's almost 12 years. Your conflict is almost old enough to have its own bar mitzvah. Can we hear a story where people solve their conflict in a healthier and maybe faster way?
Okay, how about faster and super fresh, like just happened? Remember my friend Dicemel from episode 6? I mentioned he lives in a house with a bunch of people. It's three couples.
Family going on. There's like two longstanding friends, business partners, like in a band with like one of the other people. We each have our partners, and it's just this very like interrelated circle.
Recently, things had gotten tense.
It all started to spiral down into like, oh, what is this like union is potentially like fracturing between all these different couples, because this shit is complicated. Like, living with a lot of people is fucking hard, especially when you're in a romantic relationship. It really is difficult to navigate all these things, and it takes a lot of like understanding and awareness. So it all hit me like just like a hammer to the face. Like, all of this is going on, but yet it hadn't really been addressed. So I felt called to kind of organize a like bit of a circle around the situation of like, can we create a space where like everybody kind of shares how they feel so we can all understand each other, and then maybe we can figure out like our needs and set some boundaries.
One person in the house had been feeling judged by some of the other people in the house, and this person was so uncomfortable they wanted to move out.
Which is kind of, it's kind of nuts. It's kind of crazy too, because when the person originally addressed us, like, she kind of had to break up with like six people. It felt, this is very intense like moment that shattered the bullshit around, and now we're a bit of a different dimension where things are a bit more real, deeper, and like complicated.
So Dicemel decided to consciously create a space where they could all talk,
and I was sort of going to set some protocols so we could like have an open discussion about that. And it's just like the situation got very like complex. It's like different emotions, rage and sadness, and like all these things that people have been feeling for a long time that they've never addressed. It was just like really intense, cathartic like experience between a group of friends. So it's like you kind of lay it all out and you kind of like air all these things that are just inside of you, and some of it is like, is, you know, it's harsh for other people to understand or take in. But yeah, it was a lot. The next day, I had actually set up for myself, just been thinking about it for months, like an intentional like mushroom journey. So like after this catharsis, the next day I kind of did this whole like, you know, I did the therapeutic like playlist, eye mask, psychedelic journey, which like for me was this like super healing, supportive, like oh man, like now I feel like I'm accessing this with other people. It feels like I've stepped into this new part of myself that I didn't really know was there, and like it feels good to like be honest with people, but be able to like express your emotions, but also like intentionally, I don't know, just be able to like communicate yourself, stand up for yourself, but also be like respectful to others and acknowledge them. And it was like, you just have to like know how to respond and kind of engage in these difficult parts because they're necessary.
For people that need a lot of processing time,
hi, me,
also Frances, writing is an effective way to do that. And no one ever has to see it.
You could pull a Rachel Bell and dump it all into a private Twitter. Or you could pull Francis and write a pretty solid email.
I think about you constantly. And I want to sleep with you again. If you'd ever want to do that. I've always thought that maybe I wasn't capable of love. That I was too selfish, or that there was something wrong with me somehow. That isn't true. I know that I've hurt you, Bobby, but I love you. And I always have.
There's something that all these stories today have in common, both with each other and with conversations with friends, and that's that they all deal with realizing that we each have an inner life that's rich and complex and worthy of being respected.
It's on us to give that respect to ourselves and to the people in our lives. And sure, we have a lot of things in common with one another, and it's always exciting to find those moments of symmetry. But it's actually the way we contrast each other that we need to remember to celebrate.
One of the things about being in a relationship that stands the test of time a little bit is a growing awareness and appreciation for differences.
Here's Dr. Martha Kelby.
So this is just a normal stage of a relationship for me, the stage where you wake up and realize, oh my gosh, I really didn't know you, or I thought some things about you that turn out not to be true, or who the heck are you anyway? And then there are opportunities at that point to either grow into appreciating differences and continuing to stay connected, or to let the relationship go. And relationships that last, people make the decision, okay, I'm going to stick with it for one reason or another. And I think in order to get through that sort of really difficult stage to a solid, excellent long-term relationship requires strategically and intentionally developing an appreciation of differences. It's not exciting or likely that any of us are going to have a relationship with somebody who's just like us. And if I did have a relationship with somebody who was just like me, I'd just be like, well, where's the novelty in that? I'm never surprised ever, you know? And there wouldn't be anything to counterbalance my challenges. There wouldn't be anything that I needed to do differently. There, you know, life would be very, very boring. I think that this speaks something to the need to appreciate diversity generally, but also in our own homes, in our own relationships. Diversity should be seen as a strength. So the ways that we're different help us be stronger if we can tolerate the heat, right? If we can tolerate some conflict, we can tolerate some hard conversations, and we can remain in a relational stance. We can seek the connection rather than the right perfect answer or the one worldview. So I think it's super complicated, but I would take that question globally. Mm-hmm. Differences are an important topic, and one that we don't talk about enough in relationships. We think that a successful relationship is between people who don't have any differences, but that is absolutely not the case. A successful relationship is between people who have come to terms with their differences and figured out how to leverage them for the greater good of all.
I just discovered a huge difference between us, Maggie, and I feel very weird about this right now.
Okay.
We might have to break up. You write in books, you hooligan.
I write in books. Yeah, of course I write in books.
I just found a note in Conversation with Friends. Sorry, Sally. Maggie wrote in your book about Joanna Newsom. Underline, what song? ? And a bunch of ha-has. I mean, I don't get it.
I mean, it's quite simple, actually. Whenever I pick up the book again, I can flip it open, and as soon as I see some of my writing, I'm taken instantly to one of my favorite parts of the book.
I'm going to get you post-its, because a book is sacred, and you should not... I don't believe in a lot of things, but I do believe that books are sacred, and especially when it's my favorite book, I feel very strongly that you wrote in it.
I agree that books are sacred, and that is exactly why I write in them.
We celebrate them in different ways, but I want my copy of Beautiful World, Where Are You Back?
I would never write in your copy. Maggie, I would never write in someone else's copy.
Maggie, I think we got to break up.
I think we can resolve this. Now that we've seen the whole series now that we've kind of gone really deep? What are your thoughts?
It's an interesting question because for me, Conversations with Friends, the book was a slice of time, still is. It's a slice of time and a lot of me talking to the different versions of the different Noams that are walking the planet in at all at one time, because just like reliving those moments of big moments in my life that ended up being big when I didn't know they were big, in complicated relationships. But then watching the series, it's contemporary. So it's not, you know, 2013, 2015, when I had a lot of those experiences and where I have been imagining the book. I mean, as you notice that I've been mentioning Antoine all the time, I have had different boyfriends. But when I read this book for the first time, it just, the way that Nick talks, the lack of communication, the frustration, but also that love and attraction that existed, that power, just for me, it was Antoine talking to me. That's why it keeps coming back. And also the fact, I mean, he was in a relationship for half of the time that we were in a relationship,
yeah,
with someone that he had been with for 9 years. And he did decide to end things with her and try and build something with me. But at that point, he was so broken and I was so broken because we were in so much pain at that point that it was sweet that we tried and we had some beautiful moments, but it didn't work out. So in the series, with Bobby and Francis being Bobby and Francis and not being just versions of Noam's everywhere, mm-hmm, out of my head, it's a different experience that I really appreciate. I think they did a very good job, and it's really art more than a lot of television shows these days.
Yeah, I agree. Overall, I would say really great experience. I'm glad that they adapted the novel the way that they did. I saw all these choices that they made, and for the most part, I think I was on board with their choices. There were a couple of sort of thematic elements that were in the novel that didn't make it in the series that I kind of missed.
Mm-hmm. Something that's great with Sally Rooney is the reoccurring themes that remind me of Murakami in a way. They're so different, but she kind of reuses her same subject matter, and she kind of flirts with religion in a way that I like. But instead of criticizing it in just a normal way, she shows it also as a coping mechanism and kind of she has a very interesting dialogue with religion. With Frances in Conversations with Friends, and one of her endometriosis episodes when she is in a lot of pain, in the haze and the feverish hallucination that she goes through, she wanders into a church and she sits there and has a conversation with herself. And in the end, she passes out in that church. And I just find that so symbolic. There's just so much symbolism. And that is a part that would have been hard to adapt.
Yeah, I get why they left that out, because I don't think it would have worked visually. I think it would have been overly dramatic.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm just remembering now that was one of the reasons that I really identified with Frances, because I went through a similar phase where when I was really depressed once, I was like, maybe like Jesus is a solution here.
Ivy.
I know. It wasn't. It turned out it wasn't. But I did explore it, you know. For me, one of the things that's kind of missing from the series, at least in the magnitude that it is in the novel, is the concept of self-harm. You know, we see one moment in the series where Frances cuts herself, and she kind of alludes to it in the short story, but it's kind of a big part of the novel.
It is. And it is in how she deals with Nick being around her.
Mm-hmm.
She hurts herself. Just pain helps her deal with a lot of the situations.
Yeah. And also the way the series ends and the way the book ends are technically the same, but I think I have more hope for them in the series than I did in the book.
Really?
You know?
I disagree.
Really?
Interesting. Yeah. No, I think in the series, I really felt the, and here we go again.
Oh, that's the exact feeling I got from the novel.
Well, I got it in a good way, and you got it in a bad way.
I got it in a, oh God, again. And then in the series, I was like, okay, again. Maybe we can do it right this time.
So I got that from the book, but it's just, yeah, it's like, here we go again. And she does in the book, I don't know how she does it. It's a bird eye view of Frances and Nick kind of moving towards her in time. And I'm with them on that journey. I was really hoping too that maybe there's going to be a second book, but that's not how Sally rolls.
Yeah, I was hoping they'd do like a Handmaid's Tale kind of thing where, you know, you start with the novel and then you go to what happens next, you know. But, well, we asked Jeannie about it and she kind of brought us back down to earth.
Go off and imagine what it would be like. Those are my favorite types of movies, my favorite types of books. They kind of leave it a little open-ended, so you're not disappointed by the, I mean, some people might be disappointed with Come and Get Me and that she's stepping back into this situation, but I think it's kind of a nice way of just like, okay, she is aware of the situation now and she is going into it with a new perspective and a bit more of an educated perspective. So I think that's that says. But I don't think I want to go back and see. I think I want to let them go off and experience it. And then whether it fails or works, you know, yeah. Kind of just want, I don't want to know. I like
give it over to the multiverse, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a bit of everything everywhere all at once. Yeah. Like.
This show is hosted and produced by me, Maggie Bowles,
and me, Noam Gadweiser.
It's written and edited by me, with assistant editing by Noam. Our supervising producer is Ryan Tillotson, with help from Tyler Nielsen, Frank Driscoll, Nick Bailey, and the entire Straw Hut team. Theme music is by Maggie Glass and Squarefish. And big thanks to Arya Vishai, Lauren Thorpe, Xavier Salas, and the Hulu team.